Americana.
Were you ever in a charge, you who read this now by the winter fireside, long after the bones of the slain have turned to dust when peace covers the land? If not, you have never known the fiercest pleasure of life. The chase is nothing to it. The most headlong hunt is tame in comparison. In the chase, the game flees and you shoot. Here the game shoots back, and every leap of the charging steed is a peril escaped or dashed aside.
The words you have just heard were written by Frederick Whitaker and are quoted in Lakeside Classics edition of General George Custer's My Life on the Plains. This program is Americana, the 12th in a series of radio essays on the American scene presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you Fine Editions.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. Perhaps you may feel that the words I read to you a moment ago are a little sanguinary and ferocious for New Year's night. Let me, in that case, make you a double excuse. In the first place, I assure you that we plan no actual carnage, either now or in the future. As Hamlet remarked to the players, it's all in good, clean fun. We do but fire our carbines and swing our sabers in jest, and couldn't be stirred out of our easy chair by a regiment of cavalry. And then, too, I have a feeling that we can stretch our benevolence and general goodwill much further if we season it with a little blood and thunder. At any rate, a midwinter mood is upon me, and I've been indulging in one of my January pleasures. Have you ever seen any of the Lakeside Classics series? They're handsome little books, bound usually in maroon with gold lettering along the spine. Nearly all of these beautifully designed and edited books are reprints of Western Americana, first-hand accounts of pioneer life in the Middle West and the Far West. The book I've been reading appeared 2 years ago in 1952. It's General George A. Custer's My Life on the Plains. And there are surely few books more delightful for midwinter reading, for here is Custer himself, Custer the cavalryman, who rose from lieutenant to brigadier general in one promotion. Custer the Indian fighter. Custer with his long golden curls and his dandy's uniform. Custer the reckless horseman, whose one great talent as a soldier was his fierce appreciation of the delights of a cavalry charge.
Were you ever in a charge? You who read this now by the winter fireside, long after the bones of the slain have turned to dust, when peace covers the land. If not, you've never known the fiercest pleasures of life. The chase is nothing to it. The most headlong hunt is tame in comparison. In the chase, the game flees and you shoot. Here the game shoots back, and every leap of the charging steed is a peril escaped or dashed aside. A sense of power and audacity that possesses the cavalier, the unity with his steed, both are perfect. The horse is as wild as the man. With glaring eyeballs and red nostrils, he rushes frantically forward at the very top of his speed, with huge bounds as different from the rhythmic precision of the gallop as the sweep of the hurricane is from the rustle of the breeze. Horse and rider are drunk with excitement, feeling and seeing nothing but the cloud of dust, the scattered flying figures, conscious of only one made desire, to reach them, to smite, smite, smite.
That was Frederick Whitaker, one of Custer's biographers. The general himself, in My Life on the Plains, cultivates a jaunty, half-humorous narrative style which is a delight to read. Here, for instance, is his pen sketch of Wild Bill Hickok, a man who has not, I feel, been done full justice either in films or on television.
Wild Bill was a strange character, just the one which a novelist might gloat over. He was a plainsman in every sense of the word, yet unlike any other of his class. In person, he was about 6'1" in height, straight as the straightest of the warriors whose implacable foe he was. Broad shoulders, well-formed chest and limbs, and a face strikingly handsome, Sharp, clear blue eyes which stared you straight in the face when in conversation. A finely shaped nose inclined to be aquiline. A well-turned mouth with lips only partially concealed by a handsome mustache. His hair and complexion were those of the perfect blonde. The former was worn in uncut ringlets, falling carelessly over his powerfully formed shoulders. Add to this figure a costume blending the immaculate neatness of the dandy with the extravagant taste and style of the frontiersman, and you have Wild Bill. Then is now the most famous scout on the plains. Wild Bill always carried two handsome ivory-handled revolvers of the large size. He was never seen without them. Where this is the common custom, brawls or personal difficulties are seldom, if ever, settled by blows. The quarrel is not from a word to a blow, but from a word to the revolver. And he who can draw and fire first is the best man. In all of the many affairs of this kind in which Wild Bill has performed a part and which has come to my knowledge, there is not a single instance in which the verdict of 12 fair-minded men would not be pronounced in his favor. That the even tenor of his way continues to be disturbed by little events of this description may be inferred from an item which has been floating lately through the columns of the press and which states that the funeral of Jim Bludsoe, who was killed the other day by Wild Bill, took place today. It then adds, the funeral expenses were borne by Wild Bill. What could be more thoughtful than this? Not only to send a fellow mortal out of the world, but to pay the expenses of the transit.
But I didn't mean to become involved in talking to you about either Custer or Hickok. Both of whom I hope we shall be able to discuss at length in later programs. All I meant to remark was that at this season of the year, I like to read what the book trade calls fine editions. Fine editions are reprints, as a rule, of old books, designed and printed with an eye to beauty as well as to readability, books luxuriously bound and illustrated. It's not surprising that in late years a great many fine editions have turned out also to be Americana, classics of American literature, or personal narratives like the General Custer book. There are few things so pleasant as to read a good book, which is also a delight to look at and to handle. A book which is really a work of the publisher's art. One of the pleasantest editions of this sort, which I've seen lately, is an unmistakably American book which was published in London. A new edition of Stephen Crane's superb novel of the Civil War, The Red Badge of Courage. The Folio Society, who prepared the edition, hit upon the excellent idea of illustrating the book profusely with photographs of the Civil War made by the great Matthew Brady. Brady, as you know, was the first man in the world to make a graphic record of what modern war is like. Stephen Crane, for his part, never saw a war, but he knew almost everything worth knowing about the subject just the same. So you look at Brady's raw farm boys in their sloppy blue uniforms stumbling across the battle-ragged landscape, and the pictures are proper echoes of Stephen Crane's words.
He expected a battle scene. There were some little fields girted and squeezed by a forest. Spread over the grass and in among the tree trunks, he could see knots and waving lines of skirmishers who were running hither and thither and firing at the landscape. A dark battle line lay upon a sun-struck clearing that gleamed orange color. A flag fluttered. Other regiments floundered up the bank. The brigade was formed in line of battle and, after a pause, started slowly through the woods in the rear of the receding skirmishers, who were continually melting into the scene to appear again farther on. They were always busy as bees, deeply absorbed in their little combats. The youth tried to observe everything. He did not use care to avoid trees and branches, and his forgotten feet were constantly knocking against stones or getting entangled in briars. He was aware that these battalions, with their commotions, were woven red and startling into the gentle fabric of softened greens and browns. It looked to be a wrong place for a battlefield. The skirmishers in advance fascinated him. Their shots into the thickets and at distant and prominent trees spoke to him of tragedies hidden, mysterious, solemn. Once the line encountered the body of a dead soldier. He lay upon his back, staring at the sky. He was dressed in an awkward suit of yellowish brown. The youth could see that the soles of his shoes had been worn to the thinness of writing paper, and from a great rent in one, the dead foot projected piteously. And it was as if fate had betrayed the soldier. In death, it exposed to his enemies the poverty which in life he had perhaps concealed from his friends. The ranks opened covertly to avoid the corpse. The invulnerable dead man forced a way for himself. The youth looked keenly at the ashen face. The wind raised the tawny beard. It moved as if a hand were stroking it. He vaguely desired to walk around and around the body and stare. The impulse of the living to try to read in dead eyes the answer to the questions.
While we're talking about American novels and fine editions, I must certainly mention a delightful book which appeared this fall, a new edition of James Fenimore Cooper's The Leatherstocking Saga. Unfortunately for myself, I never became involved with Cooper when I was young. Even now, I've read only fragments of his great tales of the old American frontier. And I don't suppose I should ever have read much more had it not been for Alan Nevins. Nevins, the historian, who apparently did read Cooper during those fine years when Cooper is best to read. Mr. Nevins suggests the nature of this wonderful experience in the first lines of his preface to the new edition of the Leatherstocking Saga.
Slanting sunlight falls through deep woods of tamarack, birch, elm, beech, and spruce. Along the rocky watercourse grows a thick cover of juniper, alder, and sassafras. In the distance suddenly gleams the bright expanse of Lake Ontario, its waves tipped with foam by the stiff breeze. As a dry stick cracks, a deer, startled by the noise, leaps swiftly away through the trees. Actually, this is Garrett's woods, mostly soft maple with some hickory, ash, and white oak. The sedgy little creek winds, for no rock could be found anywhere in this flat Illinois country, widening occasionally into a cattail pool. In the distance appears the tawny expanse of the CB&Q railroad reservoir, a muddy bottomed pond of 30 acres with a pumping station at the foot. As a dry stick cracks, a grazing cow lifts an inquiring head beside a mullein stalk. Chingachgo, slipping with steadily tread from tree to tree, suddenly stiffens with alarm. Hawkeye, Hutter, Uncas, and Hurry Harry, following in single file, freeze in their tracks. A mute gesture suffices. Uncas, crouched double, slips to the left to scout the Mingo position. Hawkeye covers his movement with lifted barrel. Hurry Harry looks for the wilted leaf that will betray an enemy in cover. Five urchins this late Saturday afternoon, released from farm tasks, have been allowed to roam down to the only bit of forest and water miles around. They have hooks and lines for the bullhead, sunfish, and perch in the reservoir. But the walk would be duller if they would not act out their recent reading. Among these farm boys, Pierce's, Cates's, Beckett's, Nevins's, Reed's, thumb-worn books are constantly current. G.A. Henty, Captain Mayne Reed, Oliver Optic, and John T. Trowbridge compete with more famous authors. But for an afternoon's expedition, Cooper best stirs the imagination.
What Mr. Nevins has done is to take the five Leatherstocking novels, the Deerslayer, the Last of the Mohicans, the Pathfinder, the Pioneers, and the Prairie, and edit them into one long, continuous account of the life and times of Natty Bumppo, otherwise known as Pathfinder, Deerslayer, or Hawkeye. The book is over 800 pages long. It's been illustrated by the late Reginald Marsh, one of America's finest book illustrators. It's handsomely bound, and it's guaranteed to keep any reader off the streets and deep in the Huron forest for some weeks to come. Of course, neither Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage nor Cooper's The Leatherstocking Saga is technically Americana. This term is reserved for the first-hand contemporary accounts of events in American history, or else for books that have themselves been a part of history. This brings me to a small publishing house which was established not long ago in Evanston for the express purpose of publishing fine editions of Western Americana. The publishing house is called the Branding Iron Press, and I can say without any local patriotism whatever that anyone who likes to read Americana or who enjoys beautiful books should have a complete set of the Branding Iron editions. The two most recent Branding Iron books which I've seen are Land of Enchantment, the memoirs of Marion Russell along the Santa Fe Trail, and William Hawkins Hedges' Pike's Peak or Busted. Both books, as the title suggests, contain the memoirs of Western pioneers. And both books, incidentally, I think you would enjoy. Let me give you a sample. This is Hedges' account of Denver in the days of the Pike's Peak gold rush.
Denver in the spring of 1860 was made up of a few good log buildings, a large number of tents and shacks, and much larger number of covered wagons. I'm not aware that Denver's exact location on the earth's surface was known to anybody at that time. That's a matter to be determined afterwards by the surveyors. We were just way out in the wild Indian country. We had no state, not even organized territorial existence. No officers to enforce the law, or indeed any written or established law to enforce. Every man carried his law on his hip. There was no sheriff, no jail, no lockup, no means of taking care of a criminal other than that of a rope around his neck and nothing for him to stand on. On the night of my visit to one of these places, I was near the door watching the manipulations of a three-card Monty man in his shirt sleeves. He was gotten up regardless, biled shirt, diamond shirt, studs and cuffs, fancy vest, jewelry, and on the bench behind him, the wonder of a tall silk hat. On the table before him were his three cards, a goodly show of bills, gold coin and dust, and two big frontier revolvers right under his hands with the muzzles pointing grimly outwards. And then it all happened more quickly than I can tell it. There was a moment's loud talking back in the room, followed by a sharp crack of a revolver and loud yells. Instantly, all was commotion, some rushing for the door, others crowding towards the scene of the trouble, and the sail of 40 rods stopped short. Several of the men behind the bar seized their weapons, jumped over the counter, and pushed their way into the crowd. At the crack of the pistol, the three-guard Monty man seized his tall hat, and into it he swept his money and his layout, set it on the bench behind him, and grabbed his revolvers. Meanwhile, I was hastily making for the door, and as I glanced back over my shoulder, I could never forget the picture presented by the three-card man, standing on the bench with his hat between his feet, waving his revolvers and shouting, "Back! Back!" He was shouting like that to the men in front of him.
When we started this program, I mentioned to you that General Custer's My Life on the Plains was one of the Lakeside Classics series. Those of you who live in Chicago or nearby will almost certainly know of the Lakeside Press and of the various publishing ventures of R.R. Donnelly and Sons. But the story of the Lakeside Classics may not be so familiar to you. Let me tell you that these books have been appearing steadily since 1903 at the rate of one a year, that they now form an indispensable library for students of Americana, that each volume appears just at Christmas time, and that these books are never sold by the publisher but given away. I'm sure that you'll agree that some explanation of all this is in order, and fortunately I can offer it to you. Here is Mr. Gaylord Donnelly of R.R. Donnelly and Sons to tell you about the Lakeside Classics. Mr. Donnelly, how did the Lakeside Classics get started?
The idea for them began with my father, T.E. Donnelly. An old friend of his at Yale went into the cutlery business. One Christmas, he sent father a gift made in his own factory. It was a beautiful set of straight-edge razors. Father was naturally pleased. He was also struck with an idea. Why wouldn't a Christmas gift, made by our own company, be the nicest way of saying Merry Christmas?
So I suppose he quite naturally thought of a book.
Yes, a well-made book was logical. But it would also be a fairly expensive item. Still, he thought we could afford it for our customers and other close friends. I spoke of a well-made book. What we felt was a quality book in every sense. Well-edited, nicely illustrated, beautifully printed and bound, and of course, with the best of materials. In every respect, a book that would be readable, durable, and comfortable. A volume not too large to be handy for your pocket. Another thing, the style and design were planned simply to wear well, no matter how styles and books might change superficially over the years. We've changed the color of the binding cloth with the beginning of each 25-volume series. Minor changes have also been made in design, but I believe you will find the classics highly credible examples of bookmaking even today. And remember, more than half a century has passed since the first one was published.
How did the Americana subject matter come to be decided on?
Well, anything along the line of American history is good and always will be. Another thing, we did not want to compete with publishers. Luckily, there is a vast amount of historical material that could not be published profitably by the regular trade publishers. Much of it is important and interesting all the same. Is also helpful to scholars and authors in the writing of history or historical novels.
Well, now, Mr. Donnelly, what do you look for in choosing books to include in this series?
First of all, something worthwhile and interesting historically. Secondly, an eyewitness or participant story and a good yarn. We like a certain amount of human interest, adventure, and suspense along with the facts of history.
And where do you find the material you want?
Many private collectors have helped to find titles. A great many of them, of course, from our distinguished editor, Milo Quaife. Also experts in the field of Americana, like Wright Howes or Everett Graff, and the late Oliver Barrett here in Chicago. Occasionally, we locate something good through someone who doesn't pretend to be an expert. He has just happened to read an old, long-out-of-print book, liked it, and thought of our classics. Usually, the originals of our books are found in the great libraries that have large Americana collections, the Chicago Public Library and the Air Collection of the Newberry Library have each supplied us with a number.
Well, Mr. Donnelly, does the press consider the classics worth continuing in view of the increased cost of making good books today?
Yes, that question came up about 2 years ago when the series reached 50 volumes. It is, as I said before, a rather costly undertaking, but it's a good way to say Merry Christmas, particularly to the good friends who have done so much for us. And it serves to show people and remind them what fine things this modern and highly mechanical printing industry can turn out, especially when that industry sticks to high standards of craftsmanship and quality, as our company tries to do.
What do you consider the most notable of the Lakeside classics?
Well, we're proud of the whole series. Every reader will have his own favorites, of course. Among the books in the series that I like especially, I might mention these. First, I have always liked Waubun by Mrs. John H. Kinsey, which was our classic for 1932. Its subtitle is The Early Day in the Northwest. Although written with what Dr. Quaife describes as a fictional outlook, it presents a remarkably good picture of early Chicago and the Northwest. The wife of the Indian trader John Kinsey was naturally in a position to tell her story, partly with the authority of an eyewitness and partly through her place in a family that took part in what went on when Chicago was a little more than Fort Durbin.
Incidentally, Mr. Donnelly, isn't your Chicago plant located near the actual scene of the Dearborn Massacre?
Yes, very near, only a block or two south of it. Another book I like is Kit Carson's autobiography, our Lakeside classic for 34. Carson had a colorful career to write about, and he made his story vivid as only an actual participant in historic happenings can.
I see that the Lakeside Classics have really touched a large part of the winning of the West, haven't they?
They have. Two other books I like particularly are what we might call Westerns. The Truth About Geronimo by Britton Davis and My Life on the Plains by General George A. Custer, published in 51 and 52, respectively.
The book about Geronimo, I take it, was a biography or a history by Britton Davis?
In a sense, yes. Davis was an Army lieutenant who was active in the campaigns against the Apaches in which Geronimo was finally conquered. Whenever anything has happened in history, tales are told and books are written that distort the facts. That happened to the facts about Chief Geronimo. Lieutenant Davis was close enough to what took place to put his finger on the errors. He was there and saw much with his own eyes. In a sense, his book debunks the wild stories circulated by other sensational and irresponsible writers. But don't suppose that his book is not exciting reading, for it really is. Most people think of Custer only in connection with the Custer Massacre. But a great deal came before that, and it is with this earlier history that this book deals. It tells a wonderful tale and presents Custer as the colorful figure he really was. It ends, of course, before the last stand that fixed his place in history and in the legend of the West. For all that might be said to the contrary, it seems to me that this book pretty well establishes Custer as a great military commander.
Yes, the Custer book is, I think, one of my own favorites in the series. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Donnelly, for coming over and talking to us.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed this very much, Mr. Maloney.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to all this talk about fine editions of Americana and American novels. I don't think that I have any special points to make, any conclusions to offer. I hope that someone gave you one or two good books for Christmas. Otherwise, it would be impolite for me to start reading, which is what I now propose to do. I'm more than 30 years behind on Natty Bumppo, and I think I'd better catch up.
Centuries of summer suns had warmed the tops of the same noble oaks and pines, sending their heats even to the tenacious roots when voices were heard calling to each other in the depths of the forest, of which the leafy surface lay bathed in the light. You have been listening to Americana, the 12th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. Musical supervision by Maury Streetmatter. Audio engineering by Ed Gulley. The quoted materials were read by myself, Bill Griskin. The books mentioned on tonight's program included Alan Nevin's new edition of Cooper's The Leather Stocking Saga, published by Pantheon Books, William Hawkins Hedges' Pike's Peak or Busted, and Marion Russell's Land of Enchantment, both published by Branding Iron Press in Evanston, Illinois. Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage, published by the Folio Society of London, and George Custer's My Life on the Plains, published by the Lakeside Press. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is NBC Radio.